dazzling escape.
Wow. It's the My Michelle Live podcast.
My Michelle Live. My Michelle Live. Entertainment review. Roll out the red carpet. Here's Michelle.
Well, it's entertainment review, and I am delighted to have with me a man who I would say knows more about James Bond than James Bond knows himself. Think about it, my friend. From 00 to Zurich, Switzerland, he has it covered in a new book. The cars, the gadgets, the women, the adversaries, the locations. But when you watch this, this is important. Why? Well, love him or not, we have pretty much all grown up with James Bond. And today we're going to do a deep dive into the franchise, into the movie magic. It's kind of like a walk through our own history. Now, my guest is pretty spectacular in his own right. Stephen Rubin has written many books. You've been greatly involved in movie magic, as I said, for some time, Stephen. Now you can add guest on My Michelle Live to your resume.
Thank you, Michelle. Please call me Steve. Stephen is way too formal.
Is it? Okay. Wow, I need something other than Michelle. If you think of a nickname, you know, just go for it, my friend. It's good to have you.
Nice to be here. Nice to talk about one of my favorite subjects in the world.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about where you started out as a James Bond fan. I mean, we have literally grown up with James Bond. So somewhere in your childhood, I'm assuming, you saw your first Bond film and you were like, yeah.
Well, even before that, my father would go on business trips and he would bring home paperback books. And generally, he liked to read Westerns. And I had no interest in reading anything about Westerns. There were about 5,000 TV series on the air Westerns, so I didn't have that intrigue. But one day, he dropped a book in my lap with a picture of a naked girl on the cover. Now, she was tastefully covered in gold paint and her privates were covered properly. But it was called Goldfinger. And I said, what is this? I was 11. The thought of looking at this book was just beyond me. I said, what is this, Dad? And he said, you might like this. It's a spy novel.
A spy novel.
It was like, what really wasn't on my radar. But in those days, this is back in the mid 60s, the kids in my middle school class were all reading the Ian Fleming James Bond novels. It was the thing, kind of like Harry Potter today. You know, it was kind of a thing to read. They all had these very colorful covers. And I got into Bond. And now it just so happened that was the year that Goldfinger was released at Christmas. And the thought of seeing a movie I had just read the book on was really kind of fresh for me. And Goldfinger was such an amazing movie experience. It opened up my pores in so many different ways. Probably severely affected my adolescence, because being exposed to James Bond at 11 is just, it's interesting. But we were catching Bond fever. I mean, the Christmas 64, the first two James Bond, Dr. No, were released kind of quietly. They weren't given a lot of fanfare. I had missed them. I didn't even know what they were. But now Goldfinger comes out. They re-release the last two Bond movies as a double feature. We go see that. And we are really into it. By Christmas 65, a year later, we get Thunderball. And then summer 66, actually 67, it took 2 years, we got You Only Live Twice. So we were totally into it. And I'm looking at your screen there and you're seeing Sean Connery as James Bond. He was my Bond. And love Sean. We all love Sean. And he was a virtual unknown. Nobody knew who Sean Connery was in 1962. My friend Jerry Pam, who was a publicist in Hollywood, called up a theater that year, the year that Dr. No was released, and asked what was playing. And they said, seen Connery in Dr. Number. Okay.
Okay.
So it was crazy. And so years go by. I graduate from UCLA with a bachelor's in history. I'm writing for the Daily Bruin. I'm starting my first book. which was called Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 to 1970, kind of an esoteric history of American war films. And it sold 500 copies. So I said to myself, if this is my fate to writing books, I should find another profession because I'm never going to make any money doing this. So I was hunting around for a subject to write about, and I realized that the James Bond movies had never been written about in a behind the scenes fashion, not in a book form. So I started reaching out, and I got Cubby Broccoli on the right day. I was invited to his office. I got a long interview with him. And then he gave me an entree to London to meet with his stepson, Michael Wilson. And I went to London the summer of 1977, and I got carte blanche. They opened all their file drawers to me. I got all that information you find critical to writing about movies. I mean, I got all the call sheets from the first 10 movies. So I knew exactly what they were shooting on certain days. So for a film historian, it was the Rosetta Stone.
Heck yeah. That's for a writer, as you are putting a book together, that's like opening a hidden treasure and just saying, yeah, take your pick, like a kid in a candy store.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've always felt that if you're going to write about the history of the movie, you've got to not only get that information, but you got to talk to as many of the participants as you can. So I spent that whole summer interviewing Bond veterans, and I came back to LA with a lot of stuff. The book came out 4 years later in 81, did very well. That sold 50,000 copies first time around. So I hit on something. I still couldn't make a total living on that, but it was meaningful to me. And then 9 years later, I was approached by a publisher in Chicago to write the James Bond movie encyclopedia, because they had success with Elvis Encyclopedia, Marilyn Monroe Encyclopedia. And now 4 editions later, this is my 4th edition. This is it.
The James Bond Encyclopedia.
Like, actually, but it's behind me on the screen.
And I'm not kidding. It starts with a double zero and it ends in Zurich, Switzerland. So you can imagine all of the things packed in between. Fairly insightful, because you cover everything. What a piece of work it is, in a very good way. And it is like a walk through our own history. We see a lot of changes, and I thought it would be interesting to talk about some of the changes from Sean Connery to Daniel Craig. What has really changed the most?
Well, we're talking about a 60-year history now, so a lot of changes. We start out very serious with Sean. You know, the humor in the early Sean Connery Bond movies was called throwaway humor. It really wasn't supposed to be comedic. It was just kind of ironic in a way. For instance, in Dr. No, when Bond is being chased by the hearse and he manages to knock them off the road and they go over a cliff and explode, the construction worker comes running up to him, says, how did it happen? And Bond says, I think they're on their way to a funeral. And so, I mean, that kind of humor was kind of fun and ironic. We get to Roger Moore in the 70s and early 80s. It starts being a little more funny. Now, a lot of people say, well, Roger Moore's Bond's movies were silly, but Roger Moore Bond's were spectacular. And they opened up the audience, a whole new generation of Bond fans who hadn't seen any of the Connerys suddenly embraces Roger Moore as the Bond. Roger was the perfect kind of iconic leader of the series, because he was a very handsome man, appealed to women very much, which is very much a part of the audience. His type of humor, a little lighter, appealed to young people. So by the 70s, you know, we're getting past Watergate, where Vietnam is over. People wanted a little lighter form of entertainment. So the seriousness of the Connery Bonds was being passed up by this more lighter humor. I mean, we have characters like Jaws, who has the steel teeth and The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, and that kind of fun. So that goes on till, let's see, Roger's last movie was released in 85. By 87, we get Timothy Dalton. The only reason we get Timothy Dalton was they wanted Pierce Brosnan, but Pierce Brosnan couldn't get out of his contract for Remington Steele. So Timothy came in, and Timothy is a fine actor, a really good actor, but I don't think he had the the panache and the quality to carry an internationally famous series like James Bond. And his second Bond movie, License to Kill, I didn't like at all. I thought it was like an extended Miami Vice episode. So we finally get Pierce Brosnan in 95, there was a 6-year hiatus because of some problems with the studio. And Pierce does is a little more of a continuation of Roger, perhaps not as funny, but a little lighter still. And then we get Daniel Craig. Now, by 2006, 15 years ago, the whole world had changed. It had become darker, grittier. Mm-hmm. Mission Impossible had come out. The Bourne series had come out. So they were looking to reboot the series in a little darker vein. So they pulled in an actor who did not have that Pierce Brosnan, Roger Moore handsome quality. I mean, Daniel Craig is kind of a street fighter. He's kind of a gritty guy. I mean, he's not an ugly man at all, but he didn't have the certain quality that Roger and Pierce had. But people liked that. They liked his gritty, mix it up type Bond. So we've got, for the last 15 years, we've had five movies from Daniel Craig, and I think he's wonderful. He's my favorite Bond since Sean Connery.
Interesting. I know that the storyline, as we're looking at moving into this new century and this new iteration, and even the future, which we'll talk about, of James Bond, there has been... Bond is iconic with misogyny on steroids, basically glamorizing, objectification and sometimes violence. But on the other hand, movies tend to now, right on the backs of wonderful films just remade without not necessarily a lot of imagination, but a lot of wokeness and hashtag Me Too kind of weaving its way in. Do you feel that the changes in the Bond franchise have kept up with some of this new era of, maybe that's not as cool as it used to be. Maybe we need to switch that. That's a hard thing because you have to balance changing ideology with not just putting out a new, another iteration of something and just adding better behavior. It can get boring. It can leave your audience kind of annoyed at being preached at and annoyed at the mediocrity. So I want to know how James Bond fits into all of that, Steve.
Well, they're walking a little bit of a tightrope. I mean, obviously, you've got to have certain things in a Bond movie. Otherwise, the audience is not going to really respond. Now, you bring up a very good point. First of all, the sexiness of the early Sean Connery Bond movies going back 60 years ago, where women were treated as objects. And I think that obviously these are very sexy movies with the most beautiful women in the world. But that whole arena was kind of abandoned in the mid 70s when Roger Moore's films started coming up. I mean, Barbara Bach comes in The Spy Who Loved Me, plays a Russian agent, and she's kind of matching wits with James Bond kind of step by step. She's his equal. So by even in the mid 70s, they were starting to change the portrait of the Bond woman or the Bond girl per se, from kind of the breathless female to someone who can handle herself. And this continues throughout the series. In the Pierce Brosnan, Michelle Yao plays a Chinese agent who, again, matches Bond step by step. In GoldenEye, Famke Janssen plays Xenia on a top. She's very much his equal. So the women have become much stronger characters. It's funny, in the latest James Bond movie, the Daniel Craig movie that's out right now, No Time to Die, both Ana de Armas and Lashana Lynch are really tough, very aggressive fighters. These are not women you want to mess around with in a dark alley. But it's interesting, the Bond movies, the levels, the sexiness has gone down, the violence has gone up.
And I think we got to get it somewhere, right?
You got to get it somewhere. American audiences seem to have no problem with violence, but they do not like women being treated, objectified to a certain extent. The producers realize, though, that the male audience is very important. So you you certainly not are going to feature women dressed as school teachers in your James Bond movie. I mean, perfect example is Ana de Armas, who has a plunging neckline in this Bond movie that reaches practically to her belly button. So the clothing and the costuming is still kind of a little tiny bit sexy, but not much. I think that in the last two Bond movies, Bond has focused really on one woman, who is the French actress, Léa Seydoux, and she's his girl. And I think that Bond's a little more monogamous now, reflecting the culture. It's funny that at one point, this goes back to either Pierce Brosnan or Timothy Dalton, someone's asking if Bond believes in safe sex. And I think Dalton or Brosnan said, this is a guy who doesn't know if he's going to live tomorrow, let alone, you know, continue. So do you think he's worried about that? But I think they have to think that way now. There's a scene in Goldfinger, which is still my favorite Bond movie, where Bond is being massaged by Dink at the poolside in Florida. And Felix Leiter comes up to him, and Bond introduces them. And then he turns to Dink and says, man talk, and he slaps her on the behind, and she goes off. If he did that today, there would be lines of people protesting the Bond movies, sexist, misogynistic, you know, outside the times. So I think when you see this movie, have you seen this latest one?
I have, yes.
Yeah, I mean, this one is pretty toeing the line. In fact, I found this Bond movie to be the most emotional Bond movie in decades.
Isn't that interesting when you dial back the misogyny and objectification, it's as though the emotive automatically goes up. I've seen that in other films. I find that really interesting. It's as though when we get away from being shallow, a natural depth comes in, and I think it really added something to this film. Would you mind if we take a look at the trailer?
Not at all.
All right, let's do that. This is the latest film, No Time to Die.
Bond, any thug can kill. I have to know I can trust you.
Well, I understand 00s have a very short life expectancy.
You're on a kite dancing in a hurricane, Mr. Bond.
Is this really what you want? Always alone?
To be able to get into a room with the enemy. Now they're just floating in the ether.
When her secret finds its way out, it'll be the death of you.
Oh my God. Target enough people.
Well, we're going to stop there. Wow. Visually, it keeps up with the times. It is a visual, fast-paced movie. As we look at this latest James Bond film, and we talk with Steve here. Steve, maintaining, I think you said it this way in somewhere in the encyclopedia, maintaining quality in an ongoing film series is quite a challenge. And I think that that has been the case in film recently. We see a lot of films just remade. It's the same story, and it worked once, it made money, so let's do it again. So it's as though there's this conflict between innovation and regurgitation.
Oh, absolutely. I think I grew up a big Star Wars lover, And the last few Star Wars movies feel like the same movie each time. There's no innovation
people
whatsoever.
Become the weapons.
It is indeed the same movie. It really is.
The same movie. And after a while, you say, I'll tell you, thank God for Mandalorian, because if I didn't really enjoy the Mandalorian series, I would have given up on Star Wars long ago. Yes. Hollywood is, you know, I'm a working writer producer in Hollywood. I'm pitching stories all the time. And I had a real mea culpa last year. I was calling up a Paramount executive I know, and he had read a script of mine and really loved it, and said, this is a perfect movie for Netflix. And I said, wait a second, why isn't this a perfect movie for Paramount? And he said, well, we only make properties, IP, you know, sequels, prequels, remakes, bestsellers. Hollywood is obsessed right now with brands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, every studio has their brands. You know, Disney has Marvel and Pixar, you know, Paramount has Star Trek.
You know what? There's a place for that. But gosh, Steve, you know, to me, it really can't stamp out innovation. I think that this happens in the music industry as well. We have just the pretty people doing the pretty songs. They're all mastered in such a way where dynamics is lost. We don't have the bands who, we don't care if they're not very good looking. Man, they're innovative. They're coming up with new ideas. You can listen to classic rock, for example, and you're listening to absolute poetry set to music, and you're thinking, wow, these lyrics are great. And you know, today we have I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It. We just have lost a bit of that innovation.
Well, when the studios were once owned by people, you know, they were family operations.
Good point.
When the studios were purchased by corporations, they don't like the answer, how's that movie going to do? Well, we don't quite know. Well, that doesn't work in the studios. What does work is if we spend $200 million on Spider-Man 4, we'll get back $1 billion. So their minds are in the clouds. They want to go for the biggest profit to the company. So what do? They keep churning out Superman and Batman and Iron Man and Spider-Man and Star Wars and Pixar. I mean, there's all these movies that have a certain guarantee because they're made enormously expensive. Now, look at the Bond movie. This Bond movie cost north of $300 million.
Oh, my
gosh. And if the studio executives from the 1960s heard that today, they would all die of heart attacks, because the first James Bond movie, released in 1962, granted it was 60 years ago, cost $1 million. If that movie failed, it wasn't going to break the bank. So there's a great pressure on these studios now to have enormous return on their movies. They're not making movies for $50 million now. They're making them for $200, $300. It's gone completely crazy. And I wish they would dial it back a little bit, you know, instead of going for the home run every time or the grand slam, maybe go for a single or a double, you know, but like you said, innovation. Let's try something a little bit different. I personally am writing a lot of comedy right now because the comedy genre has gone totally into the toilet. Whenever you see a studio comedy, generally it's very raunchy. And the family audience is not being served. That, you know, I am a perfect example. I stood in front of a multiplex a few years ago with my 8 and my 10-year-old and my 85-year-old mother-in-law, and we were trying to figure out what to see. We ended up going to see The Hangover Part 2. And that was not definitely a kid-friendly movie. It was just not. And I think that it's motivated me to try to get family movies out there. Our favorite movies of all time, The Wizard of Oz, Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, Night at the Museum. These are big family comedies that you can take the audience to, and they're innovative. Also, National Treasure, which is my favorite Nicolas Cage movie.
Right. That movie doesn't get old to me. I don't know if it's just that history fascinates me and it's just a fun take on something that you don't see in American history very much, that kind of intrigue that you can see in old world kind of genres, things that take on the old world or things in Europe or the ancient, the pyramids, the mummy. That I like that film a lot too.
Oh, yeah. Now, the Bond people need to be saluted because they brought out this Bond movie and it's still what it has always been. It's still good family entertainment. There was nothing in No Time to Die that would dissuade me from bringing an 8 or a 10-year-old or my 85-year-old mother-in-law, who's now 95. But basically, they've always known exactly who their audience is. And then the stories may become a little more woke and there's less sexiness, more action. But I think that families get a guarantee with a Bond movie of adventure and something that they all will enjoy. And I think that's why the series is almost 60 years old.
Probably. And it does pay to know before you go if you do have kids. There is still a lot of violence. And if that kind of glorification isn't for you, well, come on, it's James Bond. We've all grown up with it. It's not a surprise, my friend. So I wanted to do something kind of fun. Two things that I wanted to take on before you have to leave us. We'll talk a little bit about the future of James Bond, but I thought maybe you and I, you're a writer. I've done some writing for stage and have acted. So I thought maybe with your immense talent, and my little bit of talent, maybe we could create our own James Bond movie. What would it be like, Steve?
That's a great challenge.
Can I pretend for just a moment that I could ascend to the level of a Bond girl? And maybe we could make it about a talk show host that comes across in her digging of information about something nefarious. Can we start there?
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. You take it from there. Where do we go, Steve? I know I'm totally putting you on the spot, but I thought it would be fun.
Well, all Bond movies generally have to start pretty much in M's office. So Bond walks in, greets Moneypenny, and gets ushered into M's office. Ralph Fiennes, who we of course know from the Harry Potter series, Bond listens to M. Say M is indicating that there's a talk show host in the United States who is giving secrets to the Chinese by code in her broadcasts. We've got to take her down, but we have to be very careful because she has lots of connections.
Ooh, I like that. I like it. Okay.
So basically, Bond is licensed to kill. So basically, I have to kill you. But I think that when I meet you, and we meet, how shall we meet? I think we meet in a spa. You're being massaged by a masseuse. And I come into the room and I continue the massage and I get to know you a little bit. And I realize that you're a very attractive, desirable woman. And maybe I shouldn't kill you or at least get to know you a little bit. So I take you dancing to the local salsa bar and we are dancing up a storm. And then I suddenly realize that you have three Chinese henchmen who are observing us while they're dancing, and as sweet and as nice as you've been, you actually want to kill me now. So basically I'm dealing with these henchmen, and as you give me a little glint in your eye to distract me, they come at me, and being James Bond, I take out the first two and then I go racing out of the club and I'm being chased by a car. Meanwhile, you get on the radio or on the phone to your other henchmen and I'm being chased by three cars filled with Chinese thugs.
I think we've got something here. I think we've got... And you see how Steve just rattled that off, because James Bond, I would say, is effectively in your blood. What I do like about the latest film is that there is a growth, a change, and we're looking at a future that might look a little bit different. I don't think that James Bond is not going to take us into the next decade. I think we're going to see more Bond films, but they may look a little different. Your thoughts?
Well, what after you see this movie and you realize it is Daniel Craig's last one, you know that they're going to totally reboot. There's a Bond waiting in the wings. Some people like Idris Elba to be the first Black Bond. Some people like Lashana Lynch, who's in this movie, to play the first female Bond. There are people who go with kind of a safe choice in Henry Cavill, who plays Superman, a very tall Bond. I like Sam Heughan, who's in that Outlander series.
Oh, yeah.
He's a possibility. Huddleston, the guy who plays Loki in the Thor movies, he's a possibility. I would prefer them to do what they did with Daniel Craig and go for somebody who's not well known, who is somebody.
I agree.
Who...
It would be refreshing, back to innovation versus regurgitation, someone that's not right. well known. I think they have the opportunity to not take their past roles and our perceptions and to create something brand new. I love that. Some of the best things that I've seen have been from unknowns. And you do get to see that, by the way, if you're watching theater, live theater. Sometimes they'll bring a big known actor to a leading role and you're going, oh boy, I think one of the only theater projections I walked out of was The King and I with Hayley Mills. She just didn't have the stage presence or voice to pull it off. But Tup Tim, oh my gosh, this unknown actress rocked it. I say that to reiterate that something new might be something innovative. And I don't need them, in my opinion, to have to change their race or their sex or their sexual orientation, which tends to be a trend right now. Sometimes you just want to see your character that you've grown to know and love maybe change himself with the times instead of writing them off and canceling. It's as though we're in thinking of changing James Bond, we want to cancel him at the same time. And I think that's just a fine line right there.
I agree 100%. I think that there's no reason why there can't be a white Bond. I mean, he's been around since 60 years and you don't want to mess with success. You know, I think that you're making good points. I mean, we're living in a culture where some people are just doing away with things, which doesn't make a lot of sense. I think there should be respect for everybody. We're working on that. Hollywood has always been kind of on the cutting edge of inclusiveness, at least in the last 10 years. I think it's working overtime all around the industry. I mean, I think that it can be carried too far. There's room for everything. I don't think every story has to have a gay character. I don't think every story has to have a character of ethnicity. I think it just needs to be a balance for mm-hmm. every audience. And I think that...
But it doesn't have to be offensive to a people group. It just doesn't have to preach the same message again and again. And I see the disturbing trend a lot, as we had talked about kids preaching an LGBTQ ideology to kids who don't need to be sexualized, you know, that teach them inclusiveness and love for their neighbor, regardless of what they look like, what their issues are, where they go to church, you know, teach that. That's fine. But we're already over sexualized in our society. So I'm with you there. I think that we can make the characters like James Bond. Look at his depth in this film. Look at his appreciation for love, the emotive, grow those things. Let's watch our characters grow rather than write them off. I'll tell you what, one thing you don't want to write off is this fabulous book, The James Bond Movie Encyclopedia. Everything that you'd want to know about James Bond is in this book. There you go. And you can click on the link right there at My Michelle Live. You'll see a picture of the book. You can click on it and pick it up. as we're getting into the holiday seasons, if you know a big Bond fan, this is the ultimate Bond book to get for them. It is really, really interesting. And as I said in the opening, love Bond films or not, it has been a part of our growing up. It's been there before most of us were born. So the James Bond franchise has affected us in one way or another. It's like a walk through history. It is very well put together, and it is as much fun as it is to listen to and talk with Steve Rubin. Steve, thank you for being with us today. What a blast.
Before I go, Michelle, I have to tell you one little interesting fact I discovered in my research. I was doing the commentary track for Never Say Never Again, which is the kind of remake of Thunderball that Sean Connery made his last appearance in. And I was interviewing a writer named Lorenzo Semple Jr. And it turned out Lorenzo Semple, who was uncredited on this rewrite, had worked with an actor named Gregory Ratoff back in the 1950s. And Gregory Ratoff was the first producer to acquire the rights to a James Bond novel, which happened to be Ian Fleming's first novel, Casino Royale. The idea at that time in 1957 was to make James Bond a woman.
Ooh.
Susan Hayward was under contract to the studio, the red-haired actress who would shortly win an Oscar for playing convicted murderer Barbara Graham in a movie called I Want to Live. And for a brief glimmer, the thought was to start a series about a female spy played by Susan Hayward. And I looked at Lorenzo like, oh my God, did you really just say that? And this is way before they obviously started moving toward Sean Connery 4 years later. So I thought that was kind of an interesting fact, considering we've been talking about how the world has changed over the years and female empowerment on all levels.
Well, there's nothing new under the sun, if we were to be really honest, so to speak. Thank you, Steve. I would love to have you back on again. There's more to talk about, not just about James Bond, but you've written an encyclopedia on the Twilight Zone, which is one of my favorite series. And oh my gosh, so many incredible lessons that were jam-packed into that series. Other great books that you've written, we can have some links there on My Michelle Live, but I hope you'll join us again. Did you have a good time? Because that's important.
I did. And I should also mention that I'm on Facebook every Saturday with a page called Steve Rubin's Saturday Night at the Movies, which is also the title of my new podcast, which I'm just starting to get into. So we're nice. going to be colleagues in that field. I review classic movies that I've seen. I also have a page called the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia, of course. And then I am also just plain old Steve Rubin. So if anybody wants to keep in touch via Facebook, I welcome them.
Absolutely. You are a wealth of knowledge. I'm sitting back here with my jaw going, my hard drive would be full, I'm telling you. And you can just rattle this off, like I said, in your blood. And I thank you for sharing that with us today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Michelle.
More entertainment at mymichellelive.com.